Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today is the award-winning author of The Fish Ladder, a travelogue come memoir inspired by the true events in her life, encompassing her early adoption, her struggle with breast cancer and miscarriage, her love of the British countryside, and how a diversion from grief evolved into a journey to the source of life itself. Catherine, thank you so much for coming on Meet the Writers. So, you're described as a nature writer, but is that how you would categorise yourself?
Nature writing, it's become so widely used recently. It seems to be put on everything, but I'm not really sure in the present moment actually what that means. It's such a vague term. I know that I'm associated with that, and writing about the natural world is very important to me. But quite what it is, I'm not too sure. I'm far more comfortable with writing about place, writing about landscape, writing about being outside. And so connection is very important to me, renewing our connections with the natural world. But I think the term nature writing, to me, means I associate it more with books like The Goshawk, The Peregrine, books that look quite specifically at natural history. And I think what I'm doing is something memoir, plays a big part in it. It's moved away from that, and it's more, I think, to do with a process of entanglement or connection with the world in which we find ourselves.
Mm. Have you always felt that connection? I mean, as a child, was that something that drove you?
I've always been more comfortable outside than inside. My parents used to take me camping from babyhood, so walking around barefoot in muddy fields while people drove in tent pegs or dug latrines was something that was always very familiar to me. And I lived in the country in my very early childhood, and I was always outside. I wandered for miles.
You mentioned your parents, and I know that you were adopted as a baby. Did you always know that about yourself, or was there a day when you were sat down and told?
No, I always knew it. It was always there as part of my narrative. I didn't particularly understand it. I have a brother who's 8 years older than me, who's not adopted. And so the way I perceived it was simply that he was found under a blackberry bush and I was chosen in the church. So I believe there was a row of cots and you went and you chose your baby and you had it baptised and then that was it, you were adopted. Mm-hmm. So he was far more sort of heathen and under a bush. I knew the church was involved somehow because I'd been born in a convent, but it was actually a sort of institution over nature argument in my brain.
Well, we'll come back to that because, of course, all of that is described in your wonderful book, The Fish Ladder. But in terms of the sort of chronology of your life, your first sort of big job was as a film editor at the BBC.
That's very generous of you, Georgina. I was a trainee assistant film editor at the BBC. I became a sound editor at the BBC and worked on a lot of movies at the BBC. I was in love with film. I adored it. I loved being in the cutting room. And the reason I never got as far as being a film editor was because the BBC went over to working digitally, which meant working in a room without windows that was dark, and the magic went out of it. Mm. So I then became a script editor, which was the same discipline in many ways, except it was working with, you could change things and you can change a screenplay, whereas in the cutting room, you've got what's there and you have to work with it.
Yeah. I mean, one of the people that you worked with as the script editor was Alan Bleasdale.
Yes, I worked for many years with Alan. We first met on an adaptation of Oliver Twist that he did for ITV. And he was actually looking for a historical researcher. That's what he'd advertised for. And I turned up for the interview with really the only script editor who'd applied for the job. And it turned out when I got there that what he really wanted was a script editor. So we worked very closely. I did his research. I actually typed up all the manuscripts for him. That's where I really learnt an enormous amount about writing, because to be with him in a room, hour after hour, day after day, while he just spoke the words, was an extraordinary privilege. I suppose I was credited as his script associate. I mean, it was a sort of supporting role that encompassed everything.
And then, of course, we come to your own writing and your wonderful book, The Fish Ladder. Tell me about the genesis of that.
Well, The Fish Ladder came about in an unusual way. The digital camera had just been invented and there was a delay. I don't know if you remember the early cameras that you'd click the shutter and then your subject would walk out of frame. So you'd have a heel exiting. And I became incredibly frustrated with this. So actually, I stopped taking photographs, ordinary holiday photographs, and I started writing a journal instead. And so the fish ladder began quite simply as the account of one holiday, the log, if you like, of a holiday in North Wales with myself and my daughter, who at that time we lived in Barcelona. There were very long holidays. The school holidays began a month earlier than they do here in the UK. And so we had an enormous amount of time together, and I observed her very, very closely. And that's how the fish ladder began. The things that happened within it, later I became sick, I developed cancer, weren't anticipated. So it wasn't as though I chose the form the book exists in to encompass the material. I just simply started writing and then things happened. So I suppose in many ways it's actually a travelogue in a good old-fashioned sense. Not that I necessarily travel very far, That's what it is. It's just a record.
And a memoir.
Yes, and a memoir, because from that position of the beach holiday, I then moved forward and backwards in time, eventually ending up doing what the book is really purports to be about, which is following a river from the sea to the source. Mm. In both a literal manner, in that I followed the Dumbeath water in Scotland from the sea to its source. And also I followed, in looking for a medical history to cope with the cancer or to inform the cancer, I ended up digging and finding my own family origins.
Now, there was one book that really influenced you in the writing of this.
Yes, it was The Highland River by Neil Gunn. Actually, it was two books. It was The Well at the World's End gave me the idea, also a book by Neil Gunn, which is about a well in a world parallel to our own, the other world, as the Celts thought of it. And it's about a man of a certain age who's at the end of his youth, who was motivated by this idea of a sort of like chagrin, an idea that he wanted to find something that he couldn't articulate in any more concrete way than this idea of going to look for the well. So I thought I'd follow in his footsteps and go and look for the well. And then two things happened. One, I lost the book. And two, I realised that the well was going to be somewhere, that the journey that that character took in the book was in a bog in Scotland, in Caithness. And bogs are very dangerous. But Gunn had written another book called The Highland River, which deals with exactly the same landscape. He's like Hardy in that way. All of his books are superimposed on the same landscape in Caithness in Scotland. So I followed that river that ran through his hometown of Dumbeath. In Dumbeath, the journey from sea to source of that little river is known as the Great Journey. So when villagers found out that that's what I'd done, I was celebrated in a minor way. They said I was the first person to have done it for 5 years, for example. So it seems slight, but within the landscape of Caithness, the river has a huge literary significance and resonance.
And, of course, just a huge backstory. There are so many myths and legends incorporated in your book, too. I mean, you talk about many of the very, very ancient rituals and the stories that are handed down over centuries.
Well, yes, I became fascinated quite early on because I didn't want the book to be political. And so I didn't really want to look at the three big religions of Judaism, Christianity and Islam in making, if you like, spiritual points. I looked instead at the Celtic mythologies and I thought, well, I'm writing about the fringes of the island of Britain. And so I look at the Celtic mythologies. And I noticed very early on that the story of the salmon of knowledge swims its way through most of those, through Scottish stories, through Welsh stories, through Irish stories, and I'm sure through Cornish stories. And they're very often about the same thing, which is trying to think of a reason why you have got this illegitimate child. So many of the salmon of knowledge stories. The salmon of knowledge is a fish that once eaten will give you all the knowledge of the world. So to go and look for it, it's a quest story, a bit like the apple in the Garden of Eden. Mm. If you eat it, you will have the answers to all your questions. But it seemed to me that many of the interlocutors wanted to know, what do I do with this baby that I've had? How do I hide it from my husband? Where do I put it? And so there was a story of, for example, an Irish saint, Finan Cam of Kinnity, of whom it was said that his mother had swum in a salmon pool at midnight and become impregnated by the fish. And that explained, A, the absence of an earthly father, and B, his extraordinary wisdom and acuity. And the mythologies are full of these lovely yarns.
And that's extraordinary, isn't it? So for millennia, women have been seeking to explain where this baby has come from, including, of course, the Bible. It's
absolutely Moses, you know, floating in the river. I found him floating in the stream.
It was Jesus, it's a virgin birth.
Oh, well, absolutely. I think Jesus, that story of trying to explain away the absence of an early father creates enormous creativity in the storyteller. You know, with all due respect, that story, yes, the story at the centre of the Christian mythology, is actually also a creation story trying to explain an absent father, an absent human father. So it's very fertile territory. And of course, I have an absent human father. I had my adoptive parents, but I don't know to this day the name of my father, the nationality of my father, and it's going to remain a mystery, which then leaves you, you know, what do you do with that absence of information? I was also intrigued by the idea of not knowing. You know, in the story of Adam and Eve, they are told by God, do not eat the fruit from the tree of knowledge. And so I thought, well, what happens if you don't eat the fruit? We're so curious these days. We're attached to our telephones all the time. We're constantly looking at Google and trying to find new information. And yet we only know a fraction of what there is to be known. And we're only ever going to know a fraction of what there is to be known. So I was interested in the idea of relaxing into this absence of knowledge, not embracing ignorance, but accepting that there are things that can be really quite important things about one's own identity, like who am I and where do I come from, that actually, for one reason or another, are going to remain a mystery. And children displaced by war, children born as a result of sperm donors or egg donors. In many American states, adopted children still do not have access to their names of their birth parents. The world is full of people who, for one reason or another, don't have that information. And so I wanted to not turn it into a positive thing, but certainly look at a way in which we can accommodate it and move on without it holding us back into this same, who am I? How do I live my life? And accepting ignorance, really.
And that is something that you tell the story of, this parallel journey. You're following the water course in your book, but you're also following your own life story. There's a wonderful piece where you talk about this coincidence, really, of ending up where you were born.
Yes, that was unusual. I had been with Alan Bleasdale working on a screenplay, and I was exhausted. We'd been together for hours, and he smokes a lot, and so we'd been in this very smoky room. And I just wanted to be on a beach. And because we were in Liverpool, I figured that if I went north, then pretty soon I'd hit a beach. And I drove to what turned out to be Crosby Beach. And I saw these signs saying that Anthony Gormley had got an installation called Another Place. So I thought, well, I'll go and look at the installation. So there I was on the beach trying to work out what the installation was, because there were all sorts of big pieces of metal from the docks. There were windmills and cranes. And then I noticed these 100 life-size casts of the artist himself, these stationary figures all over the beach. And I just had this feeling. I was at a river mouth. I was at the Great Mersey Estuary. I could feel that extraordinary tidal pull, the same pull that the salmon would have felt, that desire to move upstream. And I just thought, this is where I'm from. Now, I knew I'd been born in Liverpool. That was on my birth certificate. And so I stopped a lady on the beach and said, is there a maternity hospital near here? And she said, well, there used to be. And it was run by the nuns. It's a convent. And it was very close by. I think it was two streets back from the beach. And so I went there and knocked on the door and said, you know, is it possible that I could have been born in this place? And the nuns said, well, yes, it is. If you were born in this part of Liverpool between these dates, we were the only maternity hospital. So if you were born in a hospital, you would have been born here. What is your name? But of course, my name had been changed because I was adopted. So I said, this is the name that you would have for me. And they both, it was two of them, raised their arms like puppets and said, oh my goodness, Sister Marie Therese. And I thought, well, who's Sister Marie Therese looking over my shoulder? And I said, could Sister Marie Therese help me? And they said, yes. And I said, could I talk to her? And they said, no, she's died, but we know who you are. And they then came out with this extraordinary story that my mother had gone into the hospital to give birth to me, and I was delivered into the hands of the midwife, a nun called Sister Marie Therese, and then left there. And so Sister Marie Therese had literally been left holding the baby, so she'd kept me. She named me after herself. The name on my birth certificate is Marie Therese, and kept me at the convent until a home could be found for me. And I had sort of known, you know, I wasn't surprised that I'd been born in a convent, because many children in the 1960s were, and I just thought it would be a Catholic mother and baby home or a home for unmarried mothers. And they said, no, we were a private nursing home. They were quite taken aback that this was unusual. And they showed me the room where I'd slept, the room where my nappies were kept, the room where they kept the powdered milk, the room where I was born. It was absolutely extraordinary and entirely coincidental, which is one of the reasons why the book takes the form of a travelogue and memoir. Because if I'd tried to put this into a novel, no one would have believed it. I think, you know, in real life, the coincidences stack up and stack up and stack up. And in fiction, you have to be far more circumspect or your reader will just say, no, you're having me on.
You've talked about not needing to know or perhaps not even wanting to know. But of course, with your diagnosis of cancer, you needed to know your medical history. And that was what that's what prompted you to try and track down your birth mother.
I think I did want to know. I do want to know, but I'm not going to be able to know. And so actually coming to terms with that barrier has really been an extraordinarily difficult obstacle to negotiate, and it's only by outing it, by writing it in the book, that I think I've actually even been able to look at it. It's extraordinarily painful to have this chasm at the heart of my life, because my mother's alive and she knows perfectly well, I imagine, who my father is and won't tell me. Mm. So, you know, there's this extraordinary anger that powers my life. So coming to terms with the idea that I'm actually not going to know has not been easy. And I think it fuels, you know, the book that I'm writing now is my new book, I think, picks up on that emotion of what it is to have a shut door and how that shut door will trickle down from generation to generation. Because it's not just me. My daughter also does not know, has never seen, apart from my brother, who I did eventually discover. But she, too, has not met that family and is closed out from it. But yes, it was the need, it was the cancer diagnosis that actually made me go and look. I don't think I would have done it otherwise. I think it would have been too painful. I knew it was going to be painful, or rather I suspected it could be, and it has been.
Well, can you tell us about that? Because you describe it so beautifully in the book.
Well, I was talking to my agent, Caradoc King, who himself was adopted, and he put me in touch with Ariel Bruce, who's a brilliant social worker who specialises in reuniting separated families. And it was really the work of only a few minutes for Ariel to find my birth mother. And she then wrote to her, but got back this extraordinarily negative response, which sort of said, this is the most horrible thing that's ever happened to me. I don't want to hear anything else on this subject. Please do not talk to me about it again. And that was the starting point from which it just got worse, because then I thought I'd try writing myself. And she wanted nothing to do with it. Now, I do understand that if you have built your life on the premise that this event never took place, then it would have been a hugely shocking discovery. But I actually can't. I think what I found hardest was that somebody to whom I am related by blood could treat anybody in that way. And I still find it, I'm still reeling. It's now 5 years later and I still reel every day. When I think, I often find myself thinking, should I have just left it? Should I have embraced knowledge? Should I not have looked for my mother? Because there isn't one day that goes by when I don't think, how could she do that? Or will she contact me? Or will I ever see her? It's always there. And I have to now, it's something I now need to negotiate, like grief.
Mm. And of course, there has been a lot of grief. And you describe again in your book, you talk about losing a baby very early on.
Yes. Funny enough, I wasn't going to put that in the book, but one of the reasons why on this particular summer holiday that I was so felt the need to do something with my hands, and so I began keeping this journal, was because I had been pregnant quite late. I mean, I was 42, and the baby would have been born that summer, but I miscarried. And so it was a big thing, you know, because I have one daughter, and I always was very aware that she had no siblings, that she was to an extent alone, or would be if anything were to befall me. And so I'd pinned a lot of hope on this baby and was devastated, really, when I lost the child. And when I wrote the first 5 drafts of the book, I didn't mention that I'd had a miscarriage. But actually, when you look at the book without that knowledge, I did appear to be behaving quite eccentrically. Throughout the summer, I would go on these long walks and we'd march up rivers and sort of get stuck in bogs and, you know, without some kind of justification as to why I was behaving in the way I was, I did appear eccentric. At one point, I drive to Hull in the middle of the night from Chester and go and walk to the end of Spurn Point, which is a spit of land that goes out into the North Sea. It's actually now fractured, but at that time you could walk straight from the mainland 3 miles into the North Sea with the Humber estuary on one side and the North Sea on the other. And when I got to the end, there's a lighthouse, and at the lighthouse was a madman throwing rocks who was there for hours. And I thought, I can't believe I've come 3 miles out onto this plank, really, to be alone with a man throwing rocks. And so it out of context, or without some kind of context, I did feel that the book looked unusual. But I didn't want to... I felt there was so much sort of difficulty in it because there's cancer and there's loss and death that I wanted... You know, the book is an optimistic book, actually. It's about embracing life. It's about the good things. It's about the friends that we have that come towards us, that fill those spaces, that, yes, there may be gaps in what is a conventional history, but actually people pop up to fill those spaces. And I have many friends, and there was much light and much joy and much laughter in the book. And also the exploration of being with my daughter. You know, I talk about reading Swallows and Amazons to her. And as I was reading Swallows and Amazons, I thought, oh my goodness, this is it. I have a child. I'm reading Swallows and Amazons to her. And this is a unique experience. And so many people, oddly, have written to me since and said, when you wrote about reading Swallows and Amazons to your daughter, you know, I read Swallows and Amazons to my son. I read Swallows and Amazons to my daughter. And it has that extraordinary magic because you're passing on the legacy and the wonder of you have been the child hearing the voice and now you're the voice. You know, we're creating memories for our children. We're creating packages that are, you know, we teach them how to put a piece of bacon rind on a hook to catch a crab. And that's magical. Mm. So the book is balanced. But I just felt that if I didn't come clean about the fact that it had started with a loss and it ends with a discovery because I discover my brother, then it just felt dishonest and unbalanced.
Mm. And of course, as you say, it has this wonderful blossoming of this young life and the coming to knowledge of your daughter Evie, who we see progress through the book to some degree. Talking about that feeling of loss and the inherited feeling of loss, and perhaps, I don't know if the field of epigenetics, for instance, feeds into this, where scientists now say that there is genetic evidence, that there are markers in your DNA of trauma suffered by the mother. And I wonder if that's something that you feel is evident in your own life.
Well, I'm very much aware of that. And certainly now my daughter is just turned 18. I'm very much aware of the legacy. You know, we all have mothers and mothers can be difficult. And now she's got a difficult mother too. And you know, this is not what I wanted. You know, you always want it to be perfect for your child. But then stuff happens that you have to respond to. And they always are there going to sort of get the fallout from that. So no, in fact, the new book that I'm writing now, the story that's at the heart of that is the story of Agamemnon and Clytemnestra, who I really think has had an extraordinarily difficult time of it, you know, being perceived as the adulterous wife who waited for her husband to come home from the wars, her heroic husband, who as soon as he came through the doors, she murdered him. And we think, what an awful, evil woman. But we forget that Agamemnon had tricked her into bringing her beautiful, beloved daughter, Iphigenia, telling her that she was going to marry the hero Achilles, and then sacrificing her and handing her round on a plate for the Greek soldiers to eat before Artemis would agree to fill the sails of the Greek fleet and send them to Troy. And so here is this mother who's had her daughter ripped from her and has spent 10 years waiting for him to come home. And as soon as he walks through the door, she murders him. And so I feel that just this idea that I feel that I'm beginning to understand what tragedy is for the first time in my life, in that it's something that passes from generation to generation and it will just keep going until everybody's dead unless someone decides to stop it. So I have become, you know, I'm intrigued by the legacy of trauma.
You don't exactly do light froth, do you, Catherine?
No, but, you know, everybody likes going to watch a tragedy. It's marvellous.
Well, The Fish Ladder has had so many just glowing accolades. It was Book of the Year 2015. That's The Telegraph. You were named Rising Star by The Observer. And this is all for
no pressure there, then.
For your first book, The Fish Ladder. What actually is a fish ladder?
It's a device. It's actually usually a set of concrete tanks, although you can make it out of any material, rising in usually 50 centimetre steps, hence the word ladder, to circumvent an object often man-made, such as a dam. And the fish ladder that I write about is the fish ladder in Pitlochry in Scotland, which was constructed to allow the fish to travel upstream around the hydroelectric power station at Pitlochry. And I was intrigued and delighted by the extraordinary simplicity of how do we allow the fish to swim upstream now that we, mankind, humankind, have built a power station which will kill them? we just built a ladder. And so I was attracted to it because it's a human-made problem with a human-made solution. And so it's that idea of collaboration and working together that, yes, we can be destructive, but we can also create the solutions that rather delighted me.
We've talked about your next book, and you are also involved in a number of other projects. So I know that you've been curating a book, Women on Nature.
I am. I'm curating a book called Women on Nature, which Unbound have asked me to do. Now, Unbound are unusual in that they crowdfund. So I essentially have to raise the finance to print the first edition. And we started that about 2 weeks ago. We've now raised, I think this morning it was 28%, maybe 29%. And so it's very exciting, but it's an odd hat to wear because I've never been a fundraiser before. Yeah. But if I can pre-sell the first edition, then we will hopefully a year from now have a beautiful book, which will be an anthology of women writing about the natural world within the Atlantic archipelago, that is Ireland and Britain and our islands, our surrounding islands. Because I feel that it has been and continues to be. Tim Dee has published a wonderful anthology of writing about nature and our relationship with the natural world. There are 32 contributors, I think, only 7 of them are women. And so even with forward-thinking, bright people looking at this field, women are extraordinarily in the minority. Mm. And so I thought, well, if we just take the women writers, and I'm going to go all the way back to Julian of Norwich, who was an ecstatic nun, maybe not ecstatic, but she had a creation-centred vision of the universe, and work my way through writers such as Emily Bronte and her beautiful writing about Howarth Moore, and Mrs. Beaton, who wrote her wonderful cookery book in which she tells you how to tell the difference between poisonous and domestic mushrooms, toadstools and mushrooms, and then bring it up to the present day so that we can actually look at the way women have approached the natural world in a different way to that canon that we started off talking about earlier, of that idea of what constitutes nature writing, because I'm not sure what constitutes nature writing, but I do know that women have been engaged with the natural world since we first, became women.
And finally, you're a student and you're also a teacher.
Yes, I am still... Oh, you've reminded me that I am a PhD candidate, coming very close to the end, hopefully, of finishing my... You've made me very nervous now, Georgina. I do have to finish my thesis within the next sort of 8 weeks. And I teach creative writing to American undergraduates in London in a study abroad programme called CAPA, which stands for the Centre for Academic Programmes Abroad. And so I teach them writing about place.
And do you think it's changed hugely?
Do I think writing about place has changed? Well, I think it's appeared as a thing. I think that people would think of fiction or life writing or memoir or, different sort of ways of writing it. I think that writing about place has become very important. I think partly because we're now in what is referred to as the Anthropocene, that is a geological age in which we human beings are without doubt the greatest contributors to the shape of the world, all this plastic that is now surrounding us. And I think that therefore there's a sort of moral imperative to engage with place such that we start to take responsibility for it. And I think really that's what it's about. So when we do our recycling, I think if you really think what happens to your rubbish when it leaves your house and the effect that it's going to have on the landfill site in which it's going to be buried, then the imperative to actually stop continuing to poison our watercourses and our soils and over-fertilise our land and eat so much meat that cattle create as much of a problem as cars, I think, in terms of methane and emissions. So I think we there's a great imperative for us to change the way we live our lives. And one way to do that is to engage with our landscape and our immediate surroundings.
Catherine, thank you so much. Catherine Norbury has written The Fish Ladder, A Journey Upstream. It's published by Bloomsbury. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Christy Evans, as well as David Stevens. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.